Chapter 82. Slowly but relentlessly, the net tightened as Macklin's dwindling force fought on. The bodies of the dead and wounded lay amid a sea of spent cartridge casings. The sun had burned away the mist. They could see their targets better now, but so could the men surrounding them. There was no fear. They knew their chances of escape were impossible from the start. Fighting far from the shores of their island fortress was nothing new to British fighting men. Macklin hobbled over to Shaw. The lieutenant had his left arm in a blood-stained sling and a foot wrapped in an equally bloody bandage. "I'm afraid we've run our course, old man. We can't keep them back much longer."
"You and your men have done a glorious job," said Shaw, "far more than anyone expected."
"They're good boys. They did their best," Macklin said wearily. "Any chance of breaking through that bloody hole?" "If I ask Caldwyler one more time how he's doing, he'll probably bash my brains out with a shovel. Might as well toss a charge down there and forget it." Shaw stared at him thoughtfully for a moment. Then suddenly he scrambled over to the edge of the pit. The men hauling up the buckets looked as if they were ready to drop from exhaustion. They were drenched in sweat and their breath came in great heaves.
"Where's Caldwyler?" asked Shaw.
"He went down himself. Said no one could dig faster than him."
Shaw leaned over the edge. The air shaft had curved and the Welshman was out of sight. Shaw yelled his name. A lump of dirt, shaped like a man, came into view far below.
"What now, damn it?
Our time has run out,"
Shaw's voice reverberated down the shaft.
"Any chance of blowing through with explosives?"
"No good,"
Caldwyler shouted up. "The walls will cave in."
"We've got to risk it."
Caldwyler sank to his knees in total exhaustion.
"All right," he said hoarsely. "Throw down a charge. I'll give it a try."
A minute later, Sergeant Bentley lowered a satchel containing plastic explosives. Caldwyler gently tapped the pliable charges into deep probe holes, set the fuses, and signaled to be pulled to the surface. When he came into reach, Shaw took him under the arms and dragged him free of the pit entrance. Caldwyler was appalled by the scene of carnage around him. Out of Macklin's original force, only 4 men were unwounded, yet they still kept up a vicious fire into the woods. The ground suddenly rumbled beneath them, and a cloud of dust spewed from the air shaft. Caldwyler immediately went back in. Shaw could hear him coughing, but his eyes could not penetrate the swirling haze.
"Did the walls hold?" Shaw yelled.
There was no answer. Then he felt a tug on the rope, and he began pulling like a madman. His arms felt as if they were about to drop off when Caldwyler's dust-encrusted head popped up. He sputtered incoherently for a moment and finally cleared his throat.
"We're in," he gasped. "We've broken through. Hurry, man, before you get yourself shot."
Macklin was there now. He shook Shaw's hand.
"If we don't see each other again, all the best."
"Same to you." Sergeant Bentley handed him a flashlight.
"You'll need this, sir."
Caldwyler had knotted 3 ropes together, increasing the length.
"This should see you to the floor of the quarry," he said. "Now, in you go."
Shaw dropped into the pit and began his descent. He paused briefly and looked up. The dust from the explosion had not settled, and all view of the anxious faces above was obscured. On the perimeter's rim, Lieutenant Sanchez's men still crouched behind trees and rocks, maintaining an intense rate of fire into the thicket-covered gully. Since the first shots, he had lost 1 dead and 8 wounded. He also had been hit, a bullet passing through his thigh and out again. He tore off his battle jacket and wrapped the entry and exit holes with his undershirt.
"Their fire has slackened," commented Sergeant Hooper between spits of tobacco.
"It's a miracle any of them are still alive in there," Sanchez said.
"Nobody fights that hard but fanatical terrorists.
They're well trained, I have to hand them that." He hesitated, listening. Then he scratched an ear and peered between 2 large boulders that shielded him.
"Listen."
Hooper's brow furrowed.
"Sir?"
"They've stopped firing."
"Could be a trick to sucker us in."
"I don't think so," said Sanchez. "Pass the word to cease fire." Soon a strange silence settled over the battle-scarred woods. Then slowly a man rose out of the thicket, his rifle held high over his head.
"Son of a bitch," Hooper muttered. "He's wearing full battle dress. Probably bought it at war surplus. Smug-looking bastard."
Sanchez rose to his feet and casually lit a cigarette. "I'm going in. If he so much as picks his nose, cut him in 2.
Stay off to the side, sir, so we have a direct line of fire. Sanchez nodded and walked forward. He stopped a yard or two away from Sergeant Bentley and looked him over. He noted the blackened face, the netted helmet with the twigs sticking out of it, and the enlisted man's insignia. There was no trace of fear in the face. In fact, there was a spreading smile. "Good morning to you, sir," greeted Bentley. "You in charge here?" "No, sir. If you will please follow me, I'll take you to him." "Are you surrendering?" Bentley nodded. "Yes, sir." Sanchez leveled his rifle. "Okay, after you." They stepped through the bushes defoliated by bullets and into the gully. Sanchez's eyes took in the scattered bodies, the gore-sopped earth. The wounded stared back at him with indifferent interest. Three men who looked unscathed snapped to attention. "Straighten up the line, lads," said Bentley sternly. Sanchez was at a loss. These men didn't fit the picture of terrorists, not any he'd seen or heard about. They appeared to be uniformed soldiers, highly disciplined and trained for combat. Bentley led him up to two men resting beside an excavated hole in the ground. The one who looked like he'd been rolling in dirt for a detergent commercial was bent over the other, cutting away a boot that was filled with blood. The man stretched beside him on the ground, gazed up at Sanchez's approach, and threw a jaunty salute. "Good morning." "A cheerful lot," thought Sanchez. "Are you in command here?" "Yes, indeed," replied Macklin. "May I have the honor of your name, sir?"
"Lieutenant Richard Sanchez, United States Marine Corps."
"Then it's Diamond Cut Diamond. I'm Lieutenant Digby Macklin of Her Majesty's Royal Marines." Sanchez stood there open-mouthed. All he could think of to mumble was, "Well, I'll be damned." The first thing Shaw noticed as he eased himself down the ventilator shaft was the dank and musty stench that welled up to meet him. After about 20 yards, he could no longer reach out with his feet and touch the encircling earth walls. He clutched the rope in a near-death grip and beamed his light into the dark. Shaw had dropped into a vast cavern, at least 40 feet from floor to ceiling. It was empty except for a large pile of debris in one corner. The rope ended 12 feet from the ground. He shoved the flashlight under his armpit, took a deep breath, and released his grip. He fell like a pebble falling down a well through the blackness, a frightening experience he would never care to repeat. A gasp was squeezed from his lungs when he landed. He should have struck clean, his legs taking most of the impact. But when he fell to one side, his outflung wrist smashed against something hard, and he heard the sickening crack as it fractured. Shaw sat there for 2 or 3 minutes, lips tightened in agony, feeling sorry for himself. Finally, he snapped abruptly to his senses, realizing it was only a question of minutes before the Americans would be coming down the air shaft, and struggled to a sitting position. Groping in his waist for the flashlight, he pushed the switch. Thank God it still worked. He found himself next to railroad tracks of a narrow gauge that ran from the cavern into a tunnel carved at one end. Awkwardly, he one-handedly slipped off his belt and made a crude sling, then rose to his feet and struck out along the track into the tunnel. He walked between the rails, careful not to trip on the raised ties. The tracks ran level for 50 yards and then started to slant up a slight incline. After a while, he stopped and played the beam into the darkness ahead. What seemed like 2 monstrous red eyes reflected back at him. Cautiously, he moved forward, stubbed his toe against something solid, looked down and saw another set of rails. They were spiked at a much wider gauge, even wider than the ones British trains ran on, Shaw judged. He came out of the tunnel into another cavern. But this was not an ordinary cavern. This was an immense crypt filled with dead. The red eyes were 2 lanterns mounted on the rear of a railroad car. On the observation platform were 2 bodies, mummies, really, still fully clothed, their blackened skulls staring into the eternal dark. The hair on the back of Shaw's head raised, and he forgot about the stabbing ache in his wrist. Pitt had been right. The underground quarry had yielded the secret of the Manhattan Limited. He glanced around, half expecting to see a shrouded figure holding a scythe, beckoning with a bony finger, beckoning for Shaw. He passed alongside the coach, noting that it was surprisingly free of rust. At the boarding steps, where the next car was coupled, another grotesque bundle lay, its head propped against the six-wheeled truck. Out of morbid curiosity, Pitt stopped and studied it. Under the flashlight, the skin showed a dark brownish-gray color and had the consistency of leather. As the months and years passed, the body had desiccated and hardened and become naturally mummified by the dry air of the quarry. The round, visored cap still resting on the head indicated that this man had been the conductor. There were others, scores of them, scattered around the train, frozen in the final posture of death. Most had died sitting up. A few were lying outstretched. Their clothing was in a remarkable state of preservation, and Shaw had no trouble telling the men from the women. Several of the dead were stiffened in warped positions below the open door to the baggage car. In front of them, a jumbled stack of wooden crates sat partly loaded into an ore car. One of the mummies had pried open a crate and was holding a rectangular-shaped block against his chest. Shaw rubbed away the grime on the object and was stunned to see the smear turn the color of gold. "My God," he thought, "by today's prices there must be over $300 million worth of the stuff lying about." Tempting as it was to linger and contemplate the riches, Shaw forced himself to push on. Sweat was soaking his clothes, yet he felt as if he were in a refrigerator. The engineer had chosen to die in the cab of his locomotive. The great iron monster was blanketed under a century of dust, but Shaw could still decipher the fancy gold numerals 88 and the red stripe that ran down the side. 30 feet in front of the cowcatcher, there was a massive fall of rock that had buried the main entrance of the quarry. More dead were strewn about here. Having dug frantically with their final breath, their gnarled hands still clutched around picks and shovels. They had actually moved several tons of stone, but it had been only an exercise in futility. 100 men couldn't have dug through that mountain of rubble in a month. How did it all happen? Shaw trembled unconsciously. There was an undeniable horror about the place. Helplessly trapped in a cold and dark underground prison, what tortures of the mind had they all endured before death ended their suffering? He continued around the locomotive and coal tender, then mounted the steps of the first Pullman car and walked down the aisle. The first sight he saw there was a woman lying in a berth, her arms embracing two small children. Shaw turned away and kept moving. He rummaged through any and all hand cases that remotely looked like they might contain the North American Treaty. The search went with frustrating slowness. He began to rush as the cold fingers of panic touched his mind. The flashlight was dimming. The batteries would not last but a few minutes longer. The seventh and last Pullman car, the one with the grisly occupants on the observation platform, bore the emblem of the American Eagle on the door. Shaw cursed himself under his breath for not starting here. He laid his hand on the knob, turned it, and passed inside. For an instant, he was taken aback by the opulence of the private coach. "They certainly don't make them like they used to," he mused. A figure wearing a derby hat with a yellowed newspaper covering his features was sprawled in a red velvet revolving chair. Two of his companions sat folded over a mahogany dining table, their heads in their arms. One was dressed in what Shaw identified as an English cut coat and trousers. The other wore a tropical worsted suit. It was the second who grabbed Shaw's interest. A withered hand clutched the grip of a small travel case. Almost as if he was afraid of waking its owner, Shaw painstakingly removed the case from under the rigid fingers. Suddenly, he froze. Out of the corner of his eye, he thought he caught an imperceptible movement. But it had to be an illusion. The wavering shadows on the walls were causing his inborn fears to run wild. If it was left to his imagination, the feeble light could make anything come alive. Then his heart stopped. A cardiologist would say that's impossible. But his heart stopped as he stared paralyzed at a reflection in the window. Behind him, the cadaver with the derby in the revolving chair was straightening to a stiff-backed position. Then the hideous thing lowered the newspaper from its face and smiled at Shaw.